Welcome to the Mid-Stage Startup Momentum Podcast. Each week, we interview up-and-coming founders of some of the fastest-growing mid-stage startups across the world. Your host is Roland Siebeling, who will share some of his own experience helping startups scale from 10 to 1,000 people in a few years. Here is Roland.
Hello and welcome to the Mid-Stage Momentum Podcast. My name is Roland Siebeling and I am a facilitator and coach and ally for many of the fastest growing startups in the world. We have today with us yet another amazing co-founder, and it's Jimmy Kim. He is the CEO and co-founder of Sendlane, dialing in all the way from sunny San Diego in Southern California. Hello, Jimmy.
Welcome to the podcast. Thanks, Roland. Thanks for having me here.
You told me in the pre-version that you do many podcasts, public speaking opportunities, because you never know what might happen. Yeah. Is that also how you started the company?
Not quite, man. our company, I mean, we'll just jump right into it, but the company started out of need and necessity. It was not started because I went to a fancy school and I had this great idea that I had a business and raise money and all that stuff. So the story of Sendlane is one of those unique ones. Sendlane is actually my third business that I've built.
Okay.
And Sendlane came out of my first two businesses. I built a tool that I needed for my business because I couldn't find the ones that I wanted. And for some reason in 2013, I thought it'd be really easy to build software. So I would just go and do this myself instead of paying these people astronomical dollars and cents that they were asking me for. So
let's delve into a little bit what the product is, because we do want people to understand that. And then we'll get back to how successful that is, that scratching your own itch as a startup model. But what does Sendlane do? Who does it serve? And what change is it making in the world?
Sure, absolutely. So Sendlane is designed, it's an email, well, today it's an email and SMS marketing automation platform for e-commerce merchants.
Yeah.
So that means that we service middle market or large SMBs, is what you can call them. They're doing anywhere from about $1 million to $100 million.
Okay.
And they're looking for a tool that can unify their stack and allow them to communicate with their customers, recover their abandoned carts, and try to get those customers from becoming a lead to a customer to repeat customer. So that's kind of what we do today. And we're a big revenue generator for the company. So often when people are using our tool properly, they're seeing 30, 40% of their revenue generated through our channels of email and SMS. So, okay, so I had a retail store that became e-commerce that I had back in 2013. And I also was running another business. It was a content creator / like micro services, software products. And so we drove majority of our revenue through email, through our customer list and through acquisition of leads and stuff like that. And so we needed a tool that would work for us, that we didn't have to be bounded by the rules of other platforms, and we needed the flexibility. And that's kind of how it started for us.
Excellent. So how far has the product come in the meanwhile? What level of maturity would you say it's at? What does it have? What does it not yet have that you would want to be building soon?
Absolutely. So over the years, we built it, rebuilt it, rebuilt it, and pivoted. Did all the things we did. This is 2013 to now, 10 years in the making, 10 years later. The product is very good. Full feature parity to any of my competitors. The big thing about us is we're disruptive, because we're not actually taking down one company. We're taking down two at once. So we're displacing two companies, actually about three here shortly, in about 30 days from now. We'll be displacing three. And the big key is all three are billion-dollar companies. So we're taking, because we've done what they've done great and proven, and we've brought them together to do the same thing together. But then it brought extra tech into the place. So we actually do more in some places because we've unified it and we don't have a data disparity or an integration between the platforms. They're actually holistically one platform. So for us, you know, our story is all about disruption, consolidation, and future. When I started building this, my pain point was email, but my pain point evolved in that sense when I started building this. It was that it wasn't just about email. It was about all the apps that you use. So a typical Shopify or BigCommerce merchant will use somewhere around 9 to 10 tools for just their MarTech. And my goal and my vision in the next couple of years, as we're continuing to build, is to eliminate all that into one. And that's really the big vision that I have, that I'm aiming towards, I'm building for, and all that stuff.
What's the key value proposition in why you're winning millions of dollars of revenue against these players? What are your customers saying? Do you do better?
Yeah, I mean, the platform's just newer, better, right? That's easy. Ease of use is obviously there. We allow you to execute on more modern playbooks because of the unification story of the product. Yeah. And then, of course, we save time and money, the biggest thing that most people care about, right? And then last, there's data attribution clarity. By unifying the channels, it's giving more people clarity around their data and being able to truly understand and measure lift on what they're working on. So those are just a handful. There's customer support. There's a million things and reasons why we win today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you already mentioned, e-commerce vendors as core customers, right? E-commerce merchants. How did you get to that specific go-to-market, that specific ICP? And what has it brought you to? How have you learned to reach them? How have you learned to build exactly what they need and so forth?
Sure. There's a lot of things there. I'll give you a little story and I'll tell you where. So back in 2018, when I started to, when I went all in on Sendlane and I exited my other two companies, I went to start building on this platform. And the first thing I did was I said, who do I need to build for? Because ultimately I can't just build for everyone. And I learned that pretty early on that you have to start verticalizing. So I did the number one most logical thing. I built for myself. That's who I was. My ICP is who I was, essentially, right? I was a $10 million e-commerce brand, right? So I knew what I needed and what I did. And I was the marketer behind the brand. Mm-hmm. So when you're the marketer and you've been in that space, you quickly recognize where you're really good at. So, you know, we started to understand that. That came into the next part of it. And really, it came into positioning. Really, the biggest thing about anything that you do when it comes to a sales team is really being able to kind of share that value prop quickly, often, and really resonate and find that pain point of the customer. So the sales team has been one of those weird things. And I'll tell you the story about it because I think it's super interesting. I failed at building that sales team three times in my career so far. Really? And by the third time, we figured it out. Third time's luck or charm, whatever they call it, right? So the first time I tried building it, we weren't ready. I tried to build a sales team when I wasn't ready, meaning founder-led sales was working, but the product was not in the market. The product and the positioning, nothing was there. Nothing was special about our platform. So in 2019, I tried for a couple months, didn't work. I shut it down. Mm-hmm. Got back to founder-led, built revenue. We're focused on revenue. In 2020, built it, pandemic hit. We started scaling, things went well. Late in 2020, I tried to hire another sales leader to hand off this thing and it failed again.
Okay.
So that time it failed because I actually think it was a different problem. We weren't able to get in front of the customers because we couldn't figure out our engine, right? We couldn't figure out our engine on how to get in front of those customers. Our marketing wasn't working. It was a very niche group of people that we had to find, not niche, but they're harder to find because we were very specific. Yeah. So we shut it down again. We backed it off again. And now on the third try, we started to figure it out. And the thing about what we had to figure out was one, we had to figure out how to get the right data in, right? Find the right data, get the right validation of data and understand. And for us, it's very easy. We use technology and technology and store sizing is pretty straightforward. There's a lot of tools that help us find that. So we figured that out. Then the second thing that comes into motion is really your positioning and your talk tracks, right? Those took a while to figure out because how do you go against a very legacy, already captured market is to come with something very shocking or different. So it took us a little bit to figure that out. And then third, it's the right people and processes behind all these, right? So we know we created this outbound team engine. We hired some BDRs, started to prove the motion, started to try to figure out our marketing, try to figure out our positioning. And over the last over a year now, we basically figured out our sales motion or go to market, our AEs are successfully hitting their quotas the way they're supposed to be. And it's been a cool journey, but with a lot of failures behind it. But that was probably the toughest thing that I've done in this business is to really get that motion working.
I see a lot of startups to follow the inbound path, often at a very low rate, right? Because they're figuring out product-led, they're figuring out marketing, lead gen, and then their sales team is usually quite junior, basically order takers, right? Yep. So you have gone in the more aggressive route of outbound earlier on than most other startups. Why did you make that choice? And how often would you recommend that?
Why did we make this choice? Well, we made the choice because we didn't believe there was any other path to create the revenue fast enough.
Yeah.
And so we made the choice that this is the right way to do it because we all have a dream that we all want to chase and it's a beautiful dream on the other end. Mm-hmm. The reality is, especially in a very hyper-competitive space, I'm in the kind of space that when you go out to raise money, the VCs tell you, hey, that space is just saturated. It's too crowded. There's too much going on. So being in that space,
invested in that 10 years ago, something yeah, like that,
being,
right?
Yeah. Being in that, being in that mindset is extremely hard. So what yeah. I really recognize was if you're going to break through the noise on this, you got to get to raw human power, yeah. raw human dialing, raw human outreach. And they have got to be treated on a one-on-one element. And especially on the early days when you don't have, when you don't need as much revenue to move the needle, it makes it a lot easier to justify.
So two questions about that. So how much was this outbound motion linked to you basically being the chief salesperson in the beginning? And two, what do you think is the right time for a startup to start moving from founder-led to an actual professional sales team?
Absolutely. So I started the motion, proved some of the early. So I go all the way back to 2020. And I remember myself and my now VP of sales, but back then he was just an account executive. Yeah. We stood back to back and we dialed 100 dials a day, man. And if I did 100 dials, I get one demo for every 30 dial roughly. And we knew that KPI. So in the mornings we dialed 100, in the afternoons we demoed and we sold, right?
Excellent.
And then we tried to scale it and I brought in a sales leader to do it and we failed at it. And I realized why. And it was because we were unique in the things that we're doing. It wasn't exactly there and the scripts weren't really nailed down. Mm-hmm. So we had to go back and figure that out and create repeatability. So to your question, your second question is when is the right time? The yeah. right time is when you can take two additional people outside of your initial UN whatever person and scale them to success.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go try to scale it out further and bring in a sales leader. But until you can prove success within around 3 to 4 people, in my opinion, you shouldn't scale.
Exactly. So does going with outbound early then also help in figuring out your positioning, figuring out your key messages, the way that you market it later, maybe when you start setting up your marketing?
Yeah. So you know what's funny is that the only way to figure out your messaging is to talk to a lot of people.
Yes.
It's such a simple statement. And I didn't recognize how important that was until I realized the magic and magic. So I'll tell you my personal unlock. And I think it's really different than probably some of them. My personal unlock is standing at trade shows and just talking to people.
Right.
Talking to 100 people a day and trying to tell them what you do at Sendlane or what the company is. And you explain to them what you're doing, how you're doing it. And you field those questions right there. And you know what's funny is over the day, your pitch gets better and better.
How important is it to be very clear on your ICP before you even start your outbound motion?
You know, that also was probably a big learning lesson that I didn't think about too well. I knew who I wanted to serve, but I tried to be really broad.
Yeah.
Then I started to shrink that thing down and shrink that thing down. And I would say when things started working better was when we shrunk it down because of messaging. That was the biggest thing. So when I go back, I'll tell you the story, Roland. It's actually interesting. Mm-hmm. A year ago, my ACVs from a year ago to an ACV today have 10X.
Oh, right? Great.
So why have we 10X? Because we went up market because we realized we were too low in market. We're trying yep. to talk to the wrong people. Mm-hmm. We couldn't sell. They cost more. They're hard to service. And we kept moving up market. And
as you move up market, many founders and salespeople actually find it challenging to also follow the price curve, right? And to dare to offer a higher price. What's been your tip on success for that?
So, you know, when we first priced ourselves, we priced ourselves with the top guys.
Yeah.
Then they started raising their prices so fast and aggressively that we couldn't keep up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think price matters as much because often the way that I look at it is price isn't that significant. Like mm-hmm. it's a very small factor of what they want from the tool and what they would need. And I don't think it's the driver. No one makes a decision because of price. It's a part of the decision, but it's not the final decision. The final mm-hmm. decision is, does it do what I need for my business and does it execute and give me the things that I need?
Have you found, on the other hand, that sometimes pricing too low makes you lose the deal?
People get suspicious, put it yes. that way. Mm-hmm. It's too cheap. And yes. I get it. I always laugh. Our cheapest plan when we first launched was $9 a month.
Okay.
Now our cheapest plan is $100 a month.
Yeah.
Right. So you're 100% right. I think pricing is one of those fun games because in your mind and most people's minds, they think, oh, if I price it cheaper, more people are going to willing to try it out. And the truth is, no, you're just going to bring in a lower value customer ultimately. Mm-hmm. So yeah. you should price yourself where you want to be and where you believe you should be. And if price should never, and I tell my founder friends this all, price should not be the driver of why you're winning or not. Right. The value prop of the product, your ability to solve their problems, and your ability to do the things you need for their business is the most important things, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Price is just the cherry on top.
Okay. So, Jimmy, we've covered product, we've covered go-to-market. Now, some founders say the other thing you're building at the same time is also a business model, like how it all fits together and how you make your profit over time. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're 100% SaaS business. Yes. We don't charge for services, nothing else. 100% SaaS. So it's all recurring revenue income.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was very focused on that from the beginning and I never wanted to sway from that. And though it was extremely hard trying to do that in the early days, I think it's well worth it as you get older, bigger and bigger as a company, because you know what you're going to get. You know your churn rate. You know all the things that happen. So predictability becomes easier. Mm-hmm. And I think the most important thing that comes into a scaling business is predictability, right? Everything about repeatability and predictability. Everything else doesn't matter, to be honest. So like what those pricing decisions early on are going to help you is going to stand that business up. And not only that, even being investable as a business, you've got to have the mantra of the right pricing model that's not so confusing that an outside person who might want to invest in a company is confused by it. So stay standard. Don't try to go outside the wheel. Like, don't try to reinvent the wheel. There's a reason why if everyone knows subscription pricing and SaaS pricing, you try to create something completely different. It could work, but a lot of times it doesn't because it just confuses the buyer even further.
Part of the SaaS business model in many cases is also to seek outside investment to live off that cash. How have you looked at that and how have you defined your investor strategy over the years?
Yeah. When people ask me about fundraising, I tell them one thing. And you're not going to be shocked by what I'm going to tell you. It's a sales cycle.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
So my first one, I'll tell you, it was funny. My first one, I never raised money in my life, in my seed round, never raised money in my life. No idea. I'm a bootstrap founder. My first two businesses, right? Mm-hmm. And so I never raised money, but I knew the concepts and the understandings of it. So what I did was very simple. Congregate a list. I got Crunchbase Pro and PitchBook Pro and
just
scraped a huge list. Then I wrote down what I thought would be what I think you're supposed to do. Write down a bunch of templates. Made this pitch deck that was horrible looking, but I thought it was great. And I just asked for meetings. And I asked a lot of people for meetings, about 3,000 people I must have emailed.
Oh, wow.
And from there, got about 150 meetings, believe it or not. I went through 150 meetings. I think I'm going to give you the exact numbers because I have a fun little infographic that I always laugh about. Let me give you these exact numbers because most guess, people
you,
laugh
you,
about
you
it.
Wrote your own software to track it.
Yes. Okay. 28 venture capitalist firms that I reached out to, right?
Yeah.
Of those, that led to 135 first meetings. Okay. And 61 of them were in person. I know we all live in a remote world now, but I walked down Sand Hill Road, Menlo Park, the Bay. I did all of that. I had 61 in person, 74 virtuals, and they all led to a 95 second calls, 29 third calls, 9 fourth calls, and 3 fifth calls, right?
Excellent. Okay.
And that all led to 3 term sheets.
I can see that stream chart already that you should post it on social media. That should be really cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of cool that like it did it, right? But here was the thing. I did that. I got term sheets. Two big lessons I got from that first learning. One, if the investor is interested and they believe in you, they're going to write your term sheet within 24 to 48 hours.
Yep.
Right? That was the first learning. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Two, don't waste your time with people who ask for a bunch of stuff.
Yes.
I learned that too. I get it, but that means they're not sold. They weren't sold and they're not sold in that first pitch. They're probably not going to be sold on you this time.
Mm-hmm. One last question about the fundraising. Is one term sheet enough?
No, never. No.
What's the minimum you need to get before you say yes?
I think you should at least get 3.
Yep.
I think 3 is a good goal to get. I know people get really excited when they get 1 and they want to sign it and they're so tired at that time that they just want to go forward. But dude, when you get 1, leverage it. I can't tell how many founders I yell at. I'm like, you got one term sheet? Tell everyone you've been talking to that you got your first term sheet. You're going to close the round soon. Watch the term sheets roll in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's basically all the leverage you need, right?
All you need is one. And it's a world of FOMO and no one wants to miss out. So by seeing one person do it, it will help. If it's a real big person, then it's even stronger.
Yes,
and then you have leverage. But until then, don't take the first thing that comes across. Make sure that you're really exploring the market and know that if one says yes, then that means other people will say yes. I've never met a founder who hasn't continued to pound the ground that's never gotten a yes. Like, you will get a yes if you hit enough people.
So that does lead me to my actual last question about fundraising, because the majority of people, unfortunately, will experience getting no term sheets, right? What do you do?
You can't. You got to keep hitting a pound. That means you haven't asked enough people.
Yes.
I promise you haven't asked enough people.
Okay.
There is someone who will say yes.
So you just keep going. You look at the kind of numbers that you mentioned before, right? Like in the thousands.
I talked to 160 people or 50 people, 60 of them in person. That's 61 hours of my life just talking to them and pitching the same thing.
I had the same experience when I did my own fundraise, like in the hundreds of meetings, right?
Yeah, so,
and that's normal and people don't realize it.
There's a reason why only 2% of startups are backed, right? Like they don't get backed because everybody who goes and asks gets a check. These companies are only investing 5 to 7 companies a year.
Yeah.
They meet thousands. You know, my capital group is Five Elms Capital that backs me on my Series A and B.
Yeah.
They just put up a chart at our last thing. They met 12,000 founders last year and invested in 6.
Yes, exactly. I always hear 1 in 1,000, but that's even lower, right?
12,000 to 6.
Exactly.
So what are they doing? A numbers game, right? You have to do the same thing.
So would you say ultimately what matters most is persistence?
Absolutely. That's it. As a founder, the number one thing is you just can never give up, man. If you believe, you believe. You got to keep pushing. There's nothing you can do otherwise. Like you have to, right? If this is your baby and you want to see it succeed and you need money, go find it somewhere.
Those are great closing words for at least the investment part, but I do want to give you an opportunity to still talk about what's the bigger vision behind Sendlane? How big is this going to be? Where do you want to be with it in 10 years' time?
Absolutely. My vision is very simple. In the future, in the next couple of years, if you have a Shopify or BigCommerce store, for example, right now, I want to be the single MarTech app that you install. I want to eliminate the 9 apps that you use. So I'm talking about, right now is email and SMS. We have reviews, loyalty, attribution, pop-ups, customer service. I want to unify that stack. I want to be the single point that allows you to do your business and run your business with one tool. My future is all about the consolidation play, focused on the 80%. That's what I tell people. I'm not focused on every whistle and bell. I'm focused on the 80% of things that most people use.
Not focused on edge cases, right?
Exactly. Not edge cases, really focused on mainstream stuff. And I just want to dominate the world in that. I want to create a new category because what we're doing right now, we're creating new categories right now. So I'm disrupting one by one by one by each category. And hopefully I'm sitting there as my only category because I'm the only one in the market that does it.
Okay. How is your team looking at the moment? Like roughly how many people are you in total? How many of those are more like product engineering versus marketing and sales?
Sure. We're about 70 people. Okay. Of 70 people, 16 of them are in engineering R&D.
Okay.
About 18 in the sales, almost 20 actually, in the sales team. Then we have marketing and CS team that fills the rest of the gap with some operations.
Okay. Okay.
We're a remote company, mostly US-based, but we do have some people overseas as well too.
Okay. And what's the perfect Sendlane employee for you? How do you recognize them?
We look for autonomous, scrappy problem solvers.
I love it.
Right? So they're not going to ask me how to solve their problem. They're going to come to me with a solution that they solve by going to Google and figuring it out.
Yeah.
Right? Other things, we have a very clear culture around how we treat each other. We have a whole rule, I call it, because we can't be mean to each other. There's no need, right? And I fire people all the time for just being jerks. We don't do jerks in this company. So for me,
That sometimes, Jimmy, when somebody's making good results and driving a lot of things for the company and yet they're a jerk, what do you do? You
gotta let them go. Why? They're so toxic and they're causing other problems. You know, what people don't understand is that if you have a jerk, it may not seem like at the outside shell because this person's performing that anything's wrong, but the people around him that are being affected by this person are usually the things that you don't recognize.
Yes.
If that makes sense, right? It spills through toxicity, right?
Yeah.
So it's a hard thing to do, but it's the thing you have to do.
What are Jimmy Kim's life pro tips on recognizing a jerk early enough?
Very easy. How do they treat their peers? Very simple. Very simple. Secondly, do they have a friend? Often when they're a jerk, they don't have friends within the company. Everybody finds a friend in a company. They don't find a friend and they seem just a little off and lone all the time. It's not because people are mean. They just don't want to be around that person.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Usually they stick out like a sore thumb. And I always tell founders, if you know they're a jerk, they're a jerk. Don't question it. Because in the gut of a founder, you know when something's wrong often. just trust
them. You don't be able to define it, but you know it's regardless.
And you know it's not, they're not a great fit for the company. And the faster you can get rid of those non-great fits for the company, the better you are. I can tell you that, especially from growing the first 100 people in the company, like whatever you do in these first 100 is going to set your foundation for how your company is going to move forward, because you can't carry that culture forever within the top. You've got to carry it throughout the team. And in order to carry it throughout the team, you basically need to build and find the right people to help you carry that through, because they will go out and hire the right people behind them.
Okay, excellent. This has been a fascinating, wonderful interview, Jamie. I did want to ask if, for all the listeners who've made it to the end, and I hope it's many, because this was indeed very interesting, how can they help SendLane? Where should they go? What should they maybe download in order to figure out more about the company?
If you have heard anything I've talked about and said, yeah, we do that, or we work on that, or do anything, there's a lot of things we do. But most of the time, I like to point people at social, because I think that's where you'll really get to learn about me. So I'm very active on LinkedIn, and I'm very active on Twitter. My LinkedIn, look me up, Jimmy Kim. My Twitter is @YoJimmyKim.
Okay.
Very active, but come find me. I chat. I'm open in the DMs. Talk to me. We'll figure it out, right? And figure out if there's anything I can help you with. I'm always happy to help people as well, too. So regardless of being in my space, or if you're on a founder journey, ask me a question. That's how I give back, because I believe that anything I can do, like my biggest thing about giving back is very simple. Anytime I see an employee leave and they go move, do and do something better, that's the most proudest moment for me. Exactly. It's what they do on their next job, not what they do at my company. It's important, but to me, I am the stepping stone for your next career. Everyone's going to have careers. I'm going to have careers. You might as well do the best for them so you can help them move up in their ladder. And that is what makes you proud, right? So it's the same thing with founders. I appreciate working with other founders to give them advice. And I hope they're way bigger than me one day so they can acquire me or they can give me money or something. But like, to me, it's been cool because I've been seeing, you know, I see different people that do eventually figure it out. They start taking off. And then, you know, what's cool? When they become big, I can still tap on their shoulder and they'll always respond to me, right?
Exactly.
And I think it works both ways. So I've seen it before. And I'm always humbled when I see him take off. So yeah.
So founders, please do take advantage of this, whether it's Jimmy or me or many of the other people with some experience in life, whether relevant or not, that you can benefit from, right? Please do, because we do love helping startup founders and teams to actually make the best of this and the next step in their career, right?
Absolutely.
Excellent closing words, Jimmy. Really appreciate you being on our podcast today. Jimmy Kim, the CEO and co-founder of SendLane. And for the audience, of course, next week we'll have a brand new episode for you guys.
Like what you heard? Subscribe to this podcast and leave a review. Tune in next time for more hot startups and interviews with some of the highest momentum startup founders in tech today.